It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the legal developments surrounding the John Doe probe against Governor Walker's past campaigns.
First, we're gearing up to head into the thick of fall movie season. After a summer of blockbusters, we're going to find out what's in store next, from the next installment of The Hunger Games to this weekend's The Equalizer.
Rob Thomas joins us now. He's an editor and writer at the Capital Times and a blogger at Madison Movie. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, get us excited here. What are you most looking forward to in this fall's crop of movies?
Well, in my circle, it's Gone Girl is the one, and I haven't even read it. So I was at a lunch with colleagues, and everybody else had read it and was very excited. And I still don't know how it ends or anything, but I think David Fincher is directing it, who did Social Network and Fight Club. And it looks like the one this fall that's like, you know, maybe an Oscar contender, but also very entertaining at the same time. Like Gravity was kind of like that about this time last year, and Argo a couple of years ago. So that's the one I'm really excited about. And plus, as a local bonus, it has Carrie Coon, who's a UW-Madison graduate and was with the American Players Theater. She has a big role in it as well.
So this could be her big role. I mean, she's in the, help me with the TV show.
The Leftovers.
The Leftovers.
The HBO series.
And she's gotten critical acclaim there, but this is a big supporting role with Ben Affleck.
Right. She did an interview with the Cap Times with Lindsay Christian. She said right now she's at a great level of fame where she's not being recognized. But I think being in like the movie version or like the book that everybody's read will may change that.
All right. Well, we have a little clip of that. This is pulled from the trailer where Nick Dunn, the main character, is being addressed by a talk show host after some bad news breaks about his wife's disappearance.
Nick Dunn, you're probably the most hated man in America right now. Did you kill your wife, Nick?
Everyone told us and told us marriage is hard work. Not for me and Nick.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago. I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife. I have nothing to hide.
Has Amy got friends we can talk to?
No, not really.
You don't know if she has friends. You don't know what she does.
There's a clip from Gone Girl, the best-selling book made into a movie. And I haven't read that one either. It's one of those where I feel like I should probably read it before
right.
I go see it, but I've got a week to read it.
I think I'm not going to make it. I think I'm going to have to experience it in the theater and then go back and fill in the blanks.
And Carrie Coon, the actress we were just talking about, looks like she'll be joining us next week. Thursday, was it?
That's the plan, right. We're going to hopefully talk to her then and hear what it's like to be starring, or not starring, but having a really big role in an important movie like this.
Well, that's a book-to-movie conversion. Here's one. Of course, all of us back in, I think, the 80s watched The Equalizer with Edward Woodward and thought, that's got to be a movie. Well, I didn't really think that ever, actually, but it is. With Denzel Washington, and we can give him a listen. He's a equalizer. He, you know, goes after criminals and evens the score.
Had enough? Because I can keep going, brick by brick, dollar by dollar, body by body. Or you can call your boss and tell him to shut down his operation tonight.
When Denzel threatens you, you stay threatened, I gather. Are you looking forward to this one, Rob?
I don't know. I mean, Denzel Washington's the sort of actor who's like, well, he's good in anything. Like, even in a movie that's like, well, why is he in this? He's still doing a pretty good job in it. I kind of agree, like, you know, the 80s series, The Equalizer, was fine, but it's like, do we really need a movie 30 years later? Like, is the Simon and Simon movie coming next year or
Ooh.
Something like that? Actually, you know what?
That's
a pretty good idea.
I'm going to go call my agent.
Yeah. So, I don't know. He seems to be entering that phase of his career, sort of the Liam Neeson phase, like older male actors get to play, you know, butt-kicking, you know, senior citizens. Kevin Costner's in that phase now, and Harrison Ford's been there for quite a while. So, I don't know, it could be good, you know. I guess we'll have to see.
And that one's out this weekend.
That's correct. Yeah. So it opens tomorrow.
And that's one of those, you know, tried and true Hollywood tradition of rebooting things and sequels. Are there a lot of those when you look ahead to the fall months?
Well, you know, actually, I mean, the summer was just full of those. I mean, there was hardly anything that wasn't based on a comic book, even if it was one no one had read, like Guardians of the Galaxy, or a TV show like 21 Jump Street. There's not as much. The fall seems to be more either true stories or based on books like Gone Girl. Little more highbrow than the summer, I think.
Is it Oscar bait time, or does that come later?
I think this is when it starts, for sure. I think like something like Gone Girl is something where, you know, that comes. That's one that could be a definite Oscar contender. Or there's one coming in October 24th called St. Vincent with Bill Murray that I think could definitely be, you know, an Oscar nomination for him. He plays this kind of cranky old veteran who takes this boy under his wing, and he looks really good.
And we've got a clip of him in St. Vincent. Let's give a listen.
Why is he mowing your dirt patch?
I'm showing him how the world works. You work, you get paid, you drink.
Are you drinking alcohol?
I honestly don't remember.
That's Melissa McCarthy,
right.
And she's got her son being cared for by Bill Murray's character, and she finds him mowing just what is should be grass, but is basically just dirt.
A dirt pile, basically a dirt lawn. Yeah,
she looks really good,
and she looks really good in it too. She's had these great over the top roles in like Bridesmaids and Heat, but this looks like a nice sort of more dramatic role for both her and for him, but also being, as tell from the clip, very funny.
Do you feel like it's hard to place Bill Murray well? I feel like he's a spectacular actor, and I always expect so much of him. But so often I feel like he's in roles that aren't quite right. They're almost right.
Well, it's interesting. He hasn't tried to be like full-on funny for a long, long time. And he picks all these kind of interesting, sort of funny, sort of dramatic. I mean, he was barely in the Grand Budapest Hotel in the spring. His last really great... I like him in everything, except that when he played FDR. That didn't work too well. But I think his last really great role was probably Lost in Translation.
Right,
that was
too.
About 10 years ago. So it's about time for him to get a really good showcase, I think.
Actually, I liked him in a Zombieland, but we can't spoil too much about his role. I probably shouldn't even say he was in it. Well, but forget that I said that, but it was good.
He's joking.
Hey, I'm getting back to a one with a Wisconsin tie. I don't know if this is Oscar category or not, but a new Jimi Hendrix biopic. What do you know about that one?
Yeah, this looks great. It's called Jimmy, All Is By My Side. It's written and directed by John Ridley, who's from the Milwaukee area, and stars Andre 3000 from Outkast, who looks uncanny as Jimi Hendrix. And it's premiering in Wisconsin at the Milwaukee Film Festival next week. And then I believe it should probably get to other theaters here later in October. It's just open in New York tomorrow. And it looks really great. And obviously John Ridley won an Oscar last year for 12 Years a Slave. So people are really excited to see this.
Now, here's a short clip of Andre 3000 as Jimi Hendrix telling a would-be British manager what he's trying to do with his music.
I want my music to go inside the soul of a person. You know, it's, for me, it's colors. I want people to feel the music the same way I see it. You know, it's just colors. It's it. And the rest is just painted with a little science fiction here and there. I don't want to freak you out. It's just early. I've got to get you over to London.
And the movie, I gather, is about Jimi Hendrix's trip to London, putting together a band there, and that's where he makes it big.
Yeah, it's like the year before the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival where he really broke huge, which I really like that rather than sort of like the cradle to grave biopic, just focusing on one really important year in his life when he was just finally breaking through.
That's interesting looking at this crop of movies here. There's a lot that I want to see already, and we haven't even talked about all of them. This summer, I think I saw maybe two movies.
Yeah.
I don't know if that says more about, you know, me or the movies or the summertime viewing habits of people. What do you think?
Well, you're an adult.
True.
A lot of the movies in the summer are aimed at kids. And, I think, and also, I mean, let's face it, the weather's getting worse, and movies going to seem a lot more attractive in Wisconsin, I think, than it does in July. But yeah, it's also, I think, movies that I think are aimed at appealing a little more to adults, get a little more meat on the bones than just like, you know, your typical superhero movie.
Well, we're talking right now with Rob Thomas about what's coming up at the movies this fall. Rob Thomas is an editor and writer at the Capital Times and a blogger at Madison Movie.
And we want to hear from you. What are you looking forward to at the movies this fall? Have you seen one of the new releases in the last couple of weeks? Is it a pick or a pan for you? And do you see fall as movie viewing season, either because of the weather or because of the content of the movies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page.
I never wanted any of this. I never wanted to be in the games. I just wanted to save my sister and keep Peeta alive.
Miss Everdeen, it's the things we love most that destroy us.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A clip there from Mockingjay Part 1, the latest in the Hunger Games franchise. We're talking upcoming fall movies right now with Rob Thomas. He's an editor and writer at the Capital Times and a blogger at Madison Movie.
And you can join the conversation. Is there a movie you're looking forward to in the next month? Is there something you're going out to see this weekend? Have you seen what's in the theaters lately? Let us know what you like or maybe what you didn't like. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And Rob, Jennifer Lawrence, back in her one of her signature roles. She's right. Got a lot of them, but this is definitely one of them that she's known for. You've got Philip Seymour Hoffman again. It was sort of bittersweet to see him in there.
For sure.
And know all the performances that we're not going to see of his down the road. What are you thinking about Hunger Games hitting?
I think the first two were really good. And again, this is another series where I haven't read the books, but I thought, they're beloved by so many people that I think they've done a great job so far. So I have high hopes for the last one, which, of course, they're splitting into two movies purely for artistic reasons, I'm sure, not because they want to double the box office or anything.
They could not think for
like
money.
That.
Shades
yeah.
of the Hobbit.
Right. Yeah. Oh, God. But I have high hopes, and I'm not sure how much Philip Seymour Hoffman got done on the movie, but it'll be very bittersweet to see him in that last one.
Yeah, and staying with the YA book-to-movie theme, Maze Runner is already out, actually. This one's already in theaters. A little listen to the trailer here.
Can you tell me your name?
I can't remember anything.
Who put us here? We don't know.
What's out there?
The maze.
Every morning when those doors open,
the runners look for a way out.
No one has ever survived a night in the maze.
So evidently there's a maze through which one runs. It's Maze Runner. So a long series of these YA, specifically dystopian series, is being turned into movies. Is there a sense of the reception to Maze Runner so far?
It was the number one movie last weekend. It opened last Friday. So it's obviously doing well. I think they already greenlighted the sequel because it's part of a trilogy, and I'm sure that last one will be made into two movies as well. But it's interesting because everything everybody tells us is that, you know, young people aren't going to movies anymore. But it seems like every other week you see, an adaptation of a young adult novel like Hunger Games or
Fault in Our Stars.
Fault in Our Stars or If I Stay. There's a whole bunch of them. So obviously there's an audience for, young people coming out, loving these books and then coming out to see the movie.
Maybe it's a young person specific to the book. Would you have the movie without the book? Would people go to see it?
Well, yeah, that's part of a larger issue with Hollywood is they won't seem to do anything unless it's based on, a book or an 80s TV show or a video game or, something like that. So, I guess as long as it makes good movies and people go, you can't complain too much.
In the book world, there's a big trend of adults reading in the young adult category, and there have been arguments about whether they should be, that sort of thing. But obviously, the audience is there. So if you're a movie maker, are you looking at this as a property that has a built-in cross-generation appeal?
That's a good point. Certainly Hunger Games, I think as many or more, or Harry Potter for that matter, as many or more adults were reading them as teenagers and kids. And that's probably, probably right now that every movie has a very specific demographic. That might be one that crosses demographics.
There's one here that I think is not based on a book. Maybe I'm wrong about this. The Theory of Everything. This is a Stephen Hawking biopic, which, we talked about earlier, sounds a little challenging to watch, also uplifting, a lot of emotional range there.
Right.
What do you know about that one?
Yeah, it's based on, I guess, A Brief History of Time would be the book, and it's a biopic about Stephen Hawking and, how he grew up and all that. Eddie Redmayne plays him and I guess is incredible in it and is playing Hawking and is probably a lock for an Oscar nomination. I think that is coming, I think I got on my list here for November 7th. It's going to open pretty wide. So that's one I think will definitely be an Oscar contender.
One I'm kind of excited about in the biopic category also, the Alan Turing biopic. It's The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch, right, of Sherlock Holmes fame.
Right. Turing was a mathematician, I think, and I think he was the one who broke the Nazi code in World War II, only to have the British government turn around and prosecute him for being gay afterwards. It's also with the Milwaukee Film Festival. It's playing next week. That was like the first sellout that they had. I think that's also going to be a big Oscar contender. And Cumberbatch, who seems to be in just about everything, it seems to be one of his best roles.
I was going to ask you about that because he's got a huge following for Sherlock, and now he's branching out and doing more and more feature films. Are we headed for Cumberbatch burnout, or do you think he's unburnoutable?
I don't know. He was like the dragon in the Hobbit movie, and he was the bad guy.
But you couldn't see him. He was just the voice.
That's true.
But he was Khan in the second Star Trek reboot.
Right. You know, it's always interesting with actors because it's like, you know, this guy's, I don't know how old, he's probably late 30s. You know, he's been toiling for like 15 years and, you know, probably doing some stage work in London and, you know, doing okay. And then all of a sudden you hit big and then like everybody starts offering you roles in everything. And do you say no or do you just kind of like strike while the fire's hot? So far, I mean, he's picking roles that are so different from each other that nobody's getting sick of him yet.
Well, here's another one on the list you sent us that I'm kind of excited about. Interstellar, science fiction movie by director Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, it's his follow-up to the last Dark Knight movie, and he's called it kind of a mirror image of Inception, and stars Matthew McConaughey as an astronaut. And if I understand from the trailers, which have been actually quite mysterious, which is unusual for trailers who usually give everything away, life on Earth is dying, and he's on part of this mission to try and find another habitable world. And it looks amazing. It looks like the kind of movie that IMAX was made for. So that comes out November 7th, and one I'm really excited about as well.
Maybe after the show you can tell me what happened in Inception. I saw it by myself, and I couldn't figure out what exactly happened at the end. I couldn't unravel it. His movies are so labyrinthine.
Yeah, I think it was that one was not even meant to be unraveled necessarily. Like, I think it ended so you had two possible outcomes at least. So
it was all just a dream, or it wasn't.
Right. Exactly. Or a dream of a dream.
Oh, how
or,
close you are. Yeah. Yes. Well, we have a caller who wanted to know about the movie Jury with Brad Pitt. Do you know anything about that?
Well, Fury, actually, I think it's called. And that looks really good. That's a World War II drama that looks like basically like Saving Private Ryan in a tank. It's like set in the last days of World War II. And it's this tank brigade that's sort of cleaning up just as the war is winding down, but it's still very dangerous. And it's supposed to be a very gritty, authentic, violent, R-rated kind of war movie. And the trailer looks great. It looks very harrowing to watch.
Well, that's on the opposite end of the spectrum. One on our list for the kids, Box Trolls.
Everybody loves this idea, don't they, Veronica? Yeah. Yeah, that opens tomorrow. I think that looks really good. It's made by this this company, animation studio in Portland called Leica, who did Coraline and Paranorman. And so what's interesting is in the age of CGI, they do stop motion animation, kind of like the Wallace and Gromit's, only they usually take a darker spin on it. So I think that looks really cool.
I'll probably end up seeing it at the mercy of my
kids,
children.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you, Rob, you know, there's been a lot of talk right now about the ascendancy of TV, that this is where the real acting and drama and the dramatic arches and the, you know, casts of thousands, this is where the action's at right now, and that films are sort of in a stagnant era. Do you buy that?
I don't know. I mean, creatively, I think, I think big budget Hollywood is still pretty afraid to do anything that doesn't have an established license behind it. I think a lot of the most creative writing is certainly going on in TV right now with Mad Men and Game of Thrones and The Leftovers and even shows like Hannibal on NBC. But I still think there's a place for movies. I still think there's an audience for it. What's interesting is now with streaming, like, people are watching movies and TV interchangeably on their tablets from Netflix and Hulu and stuff like that. So, TV's time is getting kind of eclipsed by that. So I think as long as it's something good, people will watch it on the big screen or on a tablet.
Is it worth it, though, to hit the big screen? Is a movie the same on a 3-inch screen or even a 30-inch screen at home?
I still swear by the big screen experience, even if it's like a movie that doesn't have, you know, big special effects like Interstellar. There's that community experience of seeing it with a room full of people, especially a comedy too or something like that. You just can't beat. Even if you have the iPhone 6, I think it's still not as big as your local multiplex.
Well, Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
We've been talking to Rob Thomas, editor and writer at the Capital Times and a blogger at Madison Movie. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look into the future of some of Wisconsin's lighthouses, many of which are currently up for auction.
Yesterday, the Seventh Circuit Federal Court of Appeals effectively sent the John Doe investigation back into the state courts with an injunction on a previous federal ruling that had blocked the investigation.
It's the latest in a legal volley over whether the so-called John Doe investigation can carry on. The case centers around the accusation that Governor Walker's past campaigns illegally coordinated with conservative groups on things like fundraising and campaign spending.
Reporter Chuck Kormack has been following this story. He joins us from our studio in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the basics. What did the appeals court decide yesterday?
Well, as you were sort of saying there, the appellate court, which heard the arguments in this case a few weeks ago in Chicago, I was down there for that, they expressed some dismay, disappointment at the time that this case was before them, and effectively then said yesterday that this case doesn't belong before us, that this is a state of Wisconsin investigation, state of Wisconsin matter, and therefore the federal district judge, Rudolph Randa in Milwaukee, basically was wrong to intercede and issue an injunction, and they have the three-judge panel has sent the case back to the Wisconsin courts.
So you might think, okay, this thing is moving around again, it's back in play, but it's actually not. It's still on hold. Can you tell us about that edge of it?
Kind of an N on the neutral, like the neutral space on your dashboard or your vehicle. So it's the state Supreme Court and appellate courts in Wisconsin are being asked to review a decision by the presiding judge in what's called John Doe 2, Gregory Peterson, who about a year ago stopped subpoenas in the case and said there was not much of a case there. So the things have been on hold, really, in a way, since then. It was later the Club for Growth, the conservative group, allegedly coordinated with Governor Walker, sued in federal court, went after the prosecutors that had been pursuing them. And that's how it got into federal court. As I say, the federal court has basically, it seems, stopped things, although there could be an appeal of yesterday. But things are not moving along at any fast clip in the state courts as far as we know.
Now, the ruling also effectively dismissed a lawsuit against the prosecutors behind us. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying. Back in February, a Club for Growth sued the prosecutors, saying that the free speech rights of Club for Growth and Eric O'Keefe, one of their leaders, had been violated, free speech rights, rights of association, and so on. Judge Randa had said, yeah, I agree with that. But the federal appeals court yesterday said, listen, this is not a matter for the federal courts.
Now, what has been the response so far, both from Governor Walker and from the Democratic Party?
Well, Governor Walker was quizzed about the ruling shortly after it came out yesterday afternoon in Milwaukee and sort of repeatedly said he praised Judge Peterson, the state court presiding judge who had basically halted things, as praised Judge Peterson as being independent from Governor Walker and independent from the governor's friends. And so the governor is basically relying, it sounds like, on Judge Peterson's a hold on things to carry the day, at least for a while.
Now, as far as how this whole thing could proceed, although the injunction is being lifted, as we said, the investigation is on hold, not going anywhere for the time being. But if the Supreme Court were to pick it up, how would that happen?
Well, they would, I guess, want to. They would say there's reason to take this up. But, you know, it's getting into the murky world of politics and law of the Wisconsin court system. State Supreme Court, as of late, has been in Governor Walker's favor on a bunch of rulings. And they could say, well, we don't really want to take up this case right now, maybe later on. Or there could be an effort to bring it up now and talk about it. I would sort of be surprised in the weeks before the November election that this would get a rapid look. The Judge Peterson ruling would get a rapid look by the state Supreme Court or an appellate court, but wouldn't completely rule it out.
But probably, you're saying, not likely to happen before the election in November.
Tough to predict. I think most people would be surprised if it came up. But again, it cannot be counted out.
Now, part of Judge Randa's earlier ruling, he had said that the documents involved in the John Doe investigation should be destroyed. Where are we with that? Is that still in place?
Well, I think that was stopped. There was a bunch of documents that came out in August, of course, suggesting that Governor Walker was urging, or his campaign staff was urging Governor Walker to tell various groups to send your money to Club for Growth. And there was a lot of money that came in from mining interests in that matter. And Democratic candidate for Governor Mary Burke has said, well, if that wasn't illegal, it ought to be. So there were documents that came out that yesterday. The appellate court said, that's all the documents we're going to release for now. There was an effort by a media group, a Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, who argued, their attorneys argued in Chicago a few weeks ago to release more documents, but the judges yesterday kept under lock and key, or wherever these things are kept these days, in computer files, about, I guess, 8 documents pertaining to the Doe case.
So here we are in the lead up to the midterm election, and that's coming up November 4th. Is this going to make any difference with voters? We've been watching this judicial ping pong going on, but is any of it going to sway people when they go to the polls?
Well, you know, what we know is that Marquette University, and it's one of his polls last week, released last week, actually still showed a majority of people, respondents said this is just politics and not something huge going on here. In fact, the percentage that said it was just politics had gone up since a poll a few months ago. In other words, all the documents that spilled out in August seemed to have indicated to some people that it was, well, just even more politics. I don't care about this. Now, you know, it's still 37% of those saying that something is going on here, and we don't quite know whether it was Walker's supporters or past supporters saying it's just politics, or if there were some past supporters of his saying, this is kind of serious. So there is still the potential, it's thought, that as Doe story continues, that it wounds him at least a little bit, at least at the state level, and it certainly potentially dims his national picture, although what happens in November with the voting matters more. But, you know, the headline in the New York Times yesterday, or this morning actually, was a court returns graft case to Wisconsin, and there was a picture of Governor Walker being interviewed, I think, in Madison. So when words like graft make the headlines, even though it's an allegation, it does sort of potentially stay worth a candidate, at least if he has national office in mind.
Now, is there any inkling of an appeal to the appeals court ruling from the Club for Growth?
Oh, yeah, it seems that there might be an attempt to get the full Seventh Circuit in Chicago to review what the 3 judges said yesterday. Now, the 3 judges that heard the case, 2 Republican appointees and 1 Democratic appointee. So I'm not sure if the full and en banc, I think they say, the full panel of appellate judges will hear this. That's also, of course, a question in the voter ID case where the ACLU and others want a full hearing at the appellate court. Don't know if either one's going to happen, either in voter ID or here in the Doe case.
So far, no court dates for you to cover yet, sounds like.
Or Sean Johnson or any of our other Gil Halstead or other legion of staff trying to keep up with this case.
All right, Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
There's a lot of things you could do with $50,000. For example, you could maybe buy a lighthouse.
That's right. The federal government is auctioning off lighthouses in Wisconsin and the broader Great Lakes region. So if you've ever dreamed of owning one of what's been romantically called America's castles, well, that time is here.
The Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal Lighthouse was auctioned off earlier this month with a high bid of $48,500. Bob Desch, Executive Director of the Door County Maritime Museum, is here with us now for this week's edition of Curious Wisconsin to talk about that lighthouse and how other lighthouses are being preserved around the Great Lakes. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, first, tell us about that Sturgeon Bay Lighthouse. What does it look like? Give us a mental picture.
Okay, it's actually the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal North Pierhead Light. That's a mouthful, but it is a large red steel structure, with a traditional light tower and lantern on one end, and then really just a big square rectangular metal building is the rest of the structure, and it's on the very end of the seawall. That is on the north side of the entrance to the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal as you come in from Lake Michigan.
And who owns these lighthouses now that we're auctioning them off?
Okay, they're presently were traditionally owned by the Lighthouse Service and then later the United States Coast Guard. And when the Coast Guard then declares a piece of lighthouse property as excess to their needs, then it either goes to the Bureau of Land Management or the General Services Administration, more commonly known as GSA, for disposal.
So tell us about their mission. How crucial were lighthouses like this one to shipping in the Great Lakes?
Oh, at one time they were incredibly important. In the days when the mariner fixed their position on the face of the earth, if you will, if they took a line of bearing from a known object, whether that's a cliff or a lighthouse, they were able to lock in on that object and take a line of position and figure out where they were there in the water. And then they also served, as the pierhead light did, to mark the entrance to a harbor or to mark an obstruction like that seawall. So the mariner, you know, back in the days of sail and even the days of, steam up until we started getting radar and GPS and Loran and some of those other navigational aids, you know, it was the way you got from one place to another safely was to use that lighthouse to know where you were and where the dangers were.
And so presumably since these are being auctioned off, those things you mentioned, GPS and others, have replaced that function. The ships are not relying on these lighthouses now.
That's true. There's still kind of a security blanket, I guess, if you will, and a lot of small boaters probably still use them to kind of generally know where they are when they're piloting in and out of a place. But the days of when a coastwise merchant vessel, you know, traveling up the coast of Lake Michigan would use the lighthouses to know where they were, those days have long passed. Now they glance down at their chart display information system, and they see exactly where their vessel is, you know, based on GPS and the compass and all kinds of other data that's being fit into this, electronic system. So they may look out the window and see the lighthouse and get a little bit of a secure feeling that this thing that they're looking at on the in the wheelhouse is accurate. But the days of relying on the lighthouse to know where they are, they've passed.
So now they're being sold off. What is it like? How do they go through the process of selling a lighthouse?
Well, once the Coast Guard is in the aids of navigation business, and so they maintain a very viable aids of navigation system that contains a whole lot of different things, you know, buoys and range lights and all those kinds of things. And the lighthouses are part of that, obviously. But it's they're not paid to be in the historic preservation business. So from the aids of navigation standpoint, you could do it a lot cheaper with a smaller, more efficient structure. But the light happens to now be in this, this archaic building. So they say, well, we still need the light, but we really don't need the building, and we're not being funded properly to maintain this thing from a historical standpoint. So they declare it excess to their needs. And then it would go either to the Bureau of Land Management or the General Services Administration, depending on, how the property was acquired by the federal government. And then it would go out in the first step under the Lighthouse Preservation Act is that it's offered to other entities of government, either federal government or state and local government or eligible nonprofits. And then that'll be transferred to those entities basically for free. And there's a very involved process. You put together a very comprehensive package of how you're going to maintain the light and what you're going to do with the light. And then the National Park Service, their history people actually review that and make a decision as to where the thing should go. As an example, there are some of these island lighthouses where they are very sensitive to bird patterns, as far as flight patterns and wildlife and all that kind of thing. And some of them have been actually transferred to, the Fish and Wildlife Service. Plum Island here off the coast of Door County is one of those places. or, you know, to a nonprofit who's going to, you know, in the historic preservation business, who's going to maintain it. If nobody takes it in that process, then it goes up for sale, basically. It goes to auction, any citizen can put a bid in. They declare a minimum bid, and then usually there's multiple bidders, and someone ends up with the lighthouse for that highest bid.
And, Bob, I've kind of buried the lead here. The thing on everyone's mind, I assume, is could you buy a lighthouse and turn it into your house?
You could. There are a lot of restrictions. It is a historic property, so it's governed by a lot of the rules of the Historic Preservation Act. And as well, it's still continuing to serve a minimal function as a navigation lane. So it kind of has to be kept the way it looks on the outside. But you could you have more liberty with the inside of that, and you deal with the State Historic Preservation Office, and you could turn it into your house. Several lighthouses have been either sold off or transferred to nonprofits, and they now function as bed and breakfasts. There are other ones that function as private residences somewhere.
So $48,500 doesn't seem like a lot for a lighthouse. I know some in the northeastern part of the country, I think Maine and thereabouts, have gone for, you know, numbers like $1 million. Why not this one?
Well, first of all, it's a big steel box. it was never intended to be lived in. The keepers for this particular lighthouse lived in a house on the shore and got out to the lighthouse on an elevated catwalk. And so it was really an equipment building. It had fog signal equipment in it and other equipment necessary for the light itself. So, it's at a lower price because it never really was a house, right? So if you're going to use it for a house or you're going to use it as a bed and breakfast, those kinds of things, it's got a long way to go to get to that place. The other one is it's on an end of a seawall, and the seawall that it is on is detached from the larger seawall that runs out there. So really it can only be accessed by this elevated causeway. There is no sewer. There is no water. The electrical power that goes out to the light is a cable that's maintained by the Coast Guard. So if you wanted more power out there for other uses, you would have to be able to arrange for that as well. So, you know, the price of the property is lower because of its location. The other thing is it sits on top of a seawall that will continue to be owned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So whoever has purchased the lighthouse will enter into a separate lease agreement with the Corps for the piece of concrete that is right beneath the light. So so those ones that are selling for pretty big bucks are usually on an island where you are acquiring the property that is around the lighthouse as well. And at one time or another, a lighthouse keeper and his family, her family lived out there. And so, you know, it's more of a house type location, easier to get to by boat and that kind of thing.
So it's a rustic fixer upper, as the real estate agents might say. Do we know what the owner's going to do with it?
We don't know yet. At this point, the General Services Administration typically does not release the name of the buyer. Having seen some of these other properties in other locations around the Great Lakes, eventually the owner sort of reveals themselves, right? The public interest, they will reveal who they are and what their intentions are to do with the light. So I don't know who it is at this point, as a maritime history guy, glad to see going to someone so that someone's going to start taking care of it, because the requirement is you gotta maintain this thing. So that's a good thing. I'll be interested to see what they decide to do with the interior of the light.
Now, you at the Maritime Museum didn't get this lighthouse, but you have another one, I understand.
Correct. Yeah, we've had a relationship with Kena Island Lighthouse, which is up near Bailey's Harbor, for quite some time. The Maritime Museum entered into a lease for that property back in the mid '70s, and when it became available through this process, we worked with the County of Door and particular county parks for the county to actually acquire that piece of property, and we manage it on behalf of the county, and we're in the midst of a literally multi-million dollar restoration project. The first couple of projects were to acquire some property so we could put a parking lot. So you can imagine acquiring waterfront property near the lighthouse for a parking lot. That was a pretty expensive endeavor all by itself. And then to upgrade the sanitary facilities from porta potties to at least a modern, if there is such a thing, pit toilet. And now we're in the midst of a $1 million-plus restoration of the exterior of the lighthouse, with plans to do the interior lighthouse as we can acquire the funds.
And are we going to be able to take a tour of that lighthouse when all this is done?
Oh, absolutely. Kena Island is open for tours right now. Even during this restoration process, we've kept the lighthouse open, and occasionally we have to close the light tower itself, which is unique at Kena Island. You can actually climb the tower in, you know, into the light tower. Occasionally during this restoration project, we've had to close it for a day or two. But other than that, you know, we've been able to keep it open, and we kind of look at it and say, this is a pretty unique opportunity to go see an added exhibit, if you will, as the restoration work goes on. And we actually looked at the big red lighthouse at the end of the pier, the Sturgeon Bay Canal Pierhead Light. And for us, with all that we're doing with Kena Island, it was just a bridge too far for us trying to take on another, you know, very expensive restoration project.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us and painting us a picture of our lighthouses.
Oh, thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Bob Desch. He's executive director of the Door County Maritime Museum, about the sale of lighthouses in Wisconsin and around the Great Lakes region by the federal government. By the way, next week on Curious Wisconsin, we will meet a cult hero from the state, Wisconsin filmmaker Mark Borchardt.
And Rob, I want to ask you before we go on, would you want to live in a lighthouse?
If you ask, like, teenage Rob, that would sound really cool. You could do a lot of cool stuff with a lighthouse. Grown-up Rob would think about all the maintenance it would involve and the wind
exactly.
And how much you'd have to insulate. So I think maybe not. Sorry.
All right. Yeah, I think I'm with you. It sounds kind of cool, though.